Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's You Are Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, hoping you all had a wonderful long weekend in celebration of Labor Day. And maybe it included some tennis, maybe it included a break from tennis and some quality family time away from the courts, or maybe a combination of the two. But in any event, hope you enjoyed that little break from the norm. We, for those of you who don't follow Parenting Aces on social media, we got a new puppy over the weekend. So things have been a little hectic around the Stone house, trying to get used to our new family member and trying to get him used to us, but it's going pretty well. Maybe you haven't seen pictures of Sully on our Facebook page or our Instagram. Take a look. He's really cute. We rescued him from a puppy rescue organization that actually my daughter volunteers with. And they rescue newborn puppies and who have been either rejected by the mom or something's happened to the parents and they can't take care of the pups. And so this organization called Bosley's Place takes them in and cares for them and finds both foster homes and forever homes for these dogs. And so that's how we came to get Sully in our family. And he's a cutie pie, but I'm just warning you guys, it's like having a new baby in the house. I am extremely sleep deprived, and so if I sound incoherent at any point during today's broadcast, I'm just going to apologize right now and blame it on lack of sleep for lack of a better excuse. Anyway, so that out of the way, let me just introduce you to today's guest, Dr. Neeru Jayanthi. Those of you who have been listening for a while have heard Dr. J on my show several times. He is now one of our local Atlantans. We're so glad to have him here. He relocated from Chicago to Atlanta. Gosh, I think it's been a little over a year ago now. And he is a tennis medicine specialist working in conjunction with Emory and has been participating in incredible research projects and giving talks all over the place. He's a busy guy. In addition to being a very accomplished tennis player himself and getting himself entrenched in the league tennis world of Atlanta, which y'all have heard me talk about before, it's crazy, crazy busy here. So I'm going to go ahead and bring Dr. J on the line because I know he's got a lot of great info to share with us today. Neeru, thanks so much for being on the show again. Welcome back from Texas, and can't wait to hear what you've got to talk about.
Sure. Actually, I got my introduction to league tennis here. We're actually really excited to make a shout-out to my USTA 5-0 team. We got to the city finals, and I got a rude awakening to how good league tennis is here by the time you get to that level. And we did not make it past the city finals, and that's actually a good reason to come to Atlanta because the tennis is so good. No matter how well you think you're hitting, there's luck at the end of it. So just lots of great players out here. And it's amazing how many opportunities there are to play tennis, much less do all the other stuff that we're trying to do on it. So happy to be out here for that. I had mentioned to you before, I'd try to, I'm giving a certain talk somewhere, wherever it is in the world, and sometimes even locally, I'd like to bring some of the information back to your show and your listeners. And some of the information, we try to always bring new information onto your show. And so most recently, Mark Kovacs held the World International Tennis Performance Association, ITPA, conference here in Atlanta area in July. Great, great, conference again, and, lots of variety of attendees and great speakers. And he asked me to give a talk on applying research to your tennis player. And, even in the medical world, when you say the word research, people start kind of yawning and go, oh, my gosh, what does that mean? And it makes me so tired and sleepy. I don't want to hear about research, but actually most of the stuff we're talking about is actually very practical and it's actually makes my day to be able to do tennis specific research. And I think that's a, a little bit of the direction I'd like to have some of our listeners here. So if I could start by, I guess, saying, you know, what does it really mean to actually do research? Well, especially when it involves tennis players. Well, the problem is that we've never really had a lot before in the past. I mean, tennis is very an anecdotal sport, especially in the coaching world. In other words, that means you would, you know, listen to whomever gives you advice based on their anecdotal experience. Say, well, like, you know, I taught a lot of players and, you know, certain number of them would actually go on and play in college, or I had this one pro, you know, and so on and so forth. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I think you have to have some experience, and that's what really that is, anecdotal experiences. But research is actually a different area where we're actually stepping out of your own comfort zone and your world of experience, but taking everyone's collective experience together and deciding which path is better for the player. And it's actually, if done well, it's a lot of work. And one of the best examples I can give of that is what the WTA did. And most recently I've been involved with some of the work from WTA on their, what's called their age eligibility rule in the 20-year review. And in the early 90s, as many of you guys know, there was a perceived problem with, you know, young players running into trouble with getting on the tour and possibly getting burnt out and retiring early and quitting their sport, which is actually very harmful for the tour. It's really reliant on a lot of the good, young, and top players staying on the tour, staying there for long periods of time, as we see with Serena and, you know, other folks who stick around. It actually it's great for the sport. So they formed a medical commission then and say, hey, look, let's identify what these problems might be and then decide on how to apply or treat it. So they decided to do, as many of you know, the age eligibility rule, which would restrict the number of tournaments and make it a phased-in approach from the age of 14 all the way up to 18. And they keep tweaking and modifying it, but in large part that the age eligibility rule, but also includes about, now has grown to, I would say, about 20 player development programs that the players are required to complete, anything from how to handle finances to how to handle media to sports medicine, sports science, and just on and on down the road, what it really means to be a player at that level. Just of note, we don't have those types of things for junior players, which is something you and I had talked about a little bit, Lisa. And so they applied this intervention, and this took years to develop and really make it the right type of thing. They interviewed many, many, many hundreds of players and staff and player support teams, and they evaluated themselves at 10 years. And at the 10-year review, they saw their great successes, which is premature retirements, went down substantially from about 7% to only 1%, meaning that retiring before the age of 22. And they saw career longevity increase and overall happiness with the tour. And really, there's no other organization, professional or really other, that has had a long-term review of their own organization and published it to look at it scientifically. And in fact, we're involved with the 20-year review now, and I can't share any of the data because it's kind of tied to the chest with WTA now, but it's just phenomenal that they continue on with reevaluating themselves to make sure they're doing the right thing. And it's
That's
that
awesome.
Type of work that actually does it. Yeah, it's no one, NFL doesn't do it, Major League Baseball, we all talk about it. They have certain rules instigated, but they don't, you know, do a self-evaluation. And I can't even tell you how many conference calls and their international conference calls and how many, you know, emails and meetings we've had over the last, I've been involved with the last 2 years to help do an evaluation, produce it, and go on, you know, go on site and recruit players and everything. And it's just absolutely, you know, it's top-notch stuff, and that's the level they'd like to keep it at. So I think that's some of the context we're talking about when you're applying it at that level.
So from a medical standpoint, Niru, do you feel like it would be important for all of the organizations to do similar type of research and maybe look at, you know, in terms of the junior players, I'm not even talking about at the professional level, but at the junior level, mm-hmm. maybe look at rates of burnout and, you know, compare how many tournaments kids are playing to the rate of burnout or rate of injury or things like that? Or is that research being done?
Yeah, well, so that's what I spent the last 10 or so years trying to do. It's so what we've learned in sports now, sports has gotten so sports specific too. So we've done a lot of youth sports research and youth sports data, talking about like the number of hours you're playing a week being less than your age. And, you know, we talked about specialization, all these other concepts before, and they can be helpful for the average kid who's making some sports selection choices. But when you get into that area where you are, you know, a full out junior tournament player, or full-time academy kid or whatever it is, only the tennis data matters to you. And so, so it really has to apply to what you are. So the caution is when we've done this, when you produce, you know, research and data, you have to look at large amounts of kids and junior players. And you have to accept that it doesn't apply to everyone. So, you know, I speak to coaches a lot, and we kind of go over some of these things, like how many tournaments should you play in a year, how many hours a week you should train. Well, that may actually go completely opposite to what you're doing at your own academy. But it doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong. You just have to recognize that maybe that's when the risk starts to increase. And maybe you have to do other interventions like screening or get them in early if they have some pain. So, for example, we know that if you do more than 16 hours a week, that you're much more likely to have injury. And that's all across the board, every sport, up to 9 times as likely, right? In fact, like a Spanish study showed that in their junior academies, they had about 50 cases of stress fractures in the back. And 100% of the cases, they did at least, you know, they did at least 16 hours a week of you know, training. And so we know that amount is a lot, it puts you at risk. But how much is necessary to be a top level player? It may be that amount. So then you have to be, if you're going to have them in that environment, I think my feeling is that you have some sort of way to identify early so you just don't get a bad stress injury that keeps you out 3 to 5 months, which is a possibility at that level. So maybe you do injury prevention screening, or, you know, you teach everyone these are the high-risk areas, the low back, the inside of the elbow, the shoulder. And if you have symptoms, you need to get that evaluated sooner rather than later because you are at risk. And so you have to balance it with the reality of how training programs go. So we have a bunch of those. We publish, actually, I try to give it to every tennis parent and family when I see them in the office. But and I can certainly send it to you as well, too, junior prevention evidence-based guidelines. Now, the problem is that there's just not enough of it. Like, the real researchers would say, hey, look, there's just, you know, just because I did like 4 or 5 of those studies in there, and there's others who've done it, Mark Kovacs has done a few, and, you know, some would argue it's not enough to, you know, to be convincing, but we have to have somewhere, you have to have some sort of speed limit, I say, and give some, mm-hmm. you know, some information. Otherwise, you know, we're kind of, you know, going without any direction. Like, baseball has pitch counts, and that was published by ASMI, and they have youth baseball pitch recommendations. And so it gives people a guide. And we know that less than half people follow it, but at least people have a source and they can, you know, refer to it, and then it's endorsed by youth baseball. So I think we do need more of that, not just from injury risk, but from player development point of view. What does it take to be, you know, a good player, top-level player?
So let me ask you this then. So you're saying 16 hours a week of training is really the threshold under which you can likely continue to play injury-free, above which you're likely to develop some sort of debilitating injury. Am I saying that right?
Well, no, yeah. And that's a part of being scientific. So, yeah, and with all due respect, sorry, Lisa.
That's why I'm asking for clarification, because I want to make sure I'm understanding.
Exactly, and that's actually how it's very easily interpreted, and then sometimes you end up being the doctor's like, no, you're playing too much. So what it means is that, for example, if you are, if you took a group of kids and you train them at more than 16 hours a week versus a group of kids at less than 16 hours a week, the group of kids who are at more than 16 hours a week are more likely to develop an injury than those that are less than 16 hours a week in tennis. And actually, even say more hours per week than their age. But it doesn't mean that they will, right? So let's say,
right,
you know, maybe they're twice as, or maybe actually the odds probably are 4 or 5 more likely, to be honest, in tennis. But so let's say 20% of the kids are getting hurt at more than 16 hours a week. Well, then maybe only 5% get it less than 5, you know. And I actually think those numbers are being pretty gracious, but it's just, you're more likely. And so in certain areas, it's more concerning.
Right. So I my reason for trying to understand this is, so we understand that most high-level, high-performance tennis players, juniors, are training at least 16 hours a week and likely significantly more than that. And whether that's because a coach has said that's what you need to do to reach the highest levels, or it is in reality what they need to do to reach the highest levels. So if let's assume that the majority of them are training higher than that, you know, more than 16 hours a week, what are some things that they need to be doing to offset the negative impact of that overtraining? And I'm using air quotes that you can't see.
Yeah, question. And number one, we'll say for runners, for example, that number is 40 miles per week, okay, of running. Like if you run, you know, more than 40 miles a week, we know that your injury risk increases significantly. But most top programs run at 60 miles a week. So they know that there's some attrition that goes on. You know, all the coaches, this is not a, you know, this is a relatively universal thing. Most college programs, the top high school programs, and some will even go higher than that, right, 60 to 80 miles a week. And so one is, and this sounds terrible, but it, like we'll use running as an example. There's just an attrition where they know that, hey, 10 or 20% of the kids aren't going to be able to make it that level, and they're just not going to be elite runners. So there's a Darwinism, survival, the fittest concept. And I'm actually okay with that concept. Like, you know, as being a college team doctor for many years at Division I level, like not everyone can play college sports. And so you have to get the people who can tolerate it and can make it all the way through. But the question is, and I always ask the coaches, how much are you willing to give up? So let's say, you know, 10% of your kids are hurt. You have your college basketball coach. And I would ask them, I say, hey, 10% of your kids are hurt. Is that acceptable? Well, with 15 kids, you have one or two kids there. That's pretty much expected, right? If 20% are hurt, when does it start impacting you and your program and, you know, and the kid themselves? So that's kind of a big picture for the coach. Now, if it's your kid, it's not that good. If you're the kid who's not making it through, and some kids have to train it, they have to train in a lower volume. And that's what we've had college athletes who, I've had college runners who run at 30 miles a week. And, you know, you have to, at some point, you could be a lower volume trainer. I mean, where you're not, you just can't tolerate 16, 20 hours a week. And, you know, you have to train. The other thing is, now it's sort of like gymnastics where they're in the gym 20 to 25 to 30 hours a week. But when they're there, it doesn't mean that they have to be doing all the gymnastics specific activities. And so some of it is off court conditioning, right? So if you're at the academy, I think, I mean, it's fine. You know, if you're there, if you're full time, that's your thing. But some period of time, you know, should be allotted towards off-court conditioning to, like you said, neutralize some of the effects of it. But it can't be the exact same things you're doing on court. So you have to have some recovery, obviously, right? You have to have, you know, some injury prevention, which is, you know, we've talked for hours about the types of things, of course, stability and upper extremity strengthening and certain areas of flexibility. And but it can't just be, you know, another hour of fitness, you know, speed drills after four-hour practice. Because there's going to be, you know, again, some negative effects of doing that. And the other part I actually think is finding a way to cross train and do activities that aren't tennis at all. And so I really still develop in developing athletic skills. I mean, kicking a soccer ball around or, you know, shooting hoops or anything else just to offload your body. And, And I think the high-risk kids, this is, of course, my personal opinion, I've said it before, would benefit from some sort of screen, some sort of evaluation where they have an access to being seen or being evaluated immediately for anything that could be of concern before it gets to be a later stage stress factor that keeps you out for 3 to 5 months. And right. We see too much of that where it's like, well, it's sore, but I got to get through this tournament. And you're like, well, can I get sore? And then all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, I can't even lean back like 5 degrees, that it hurts so much. And then it's already too late. And so we want to try to avert those things when we can.
I had Jeff Rothschild on the show a few months ago. And one of the things that he talks a lot about is the impact that sleep has on performance. And I'm wondering if y'all are looking at that, you know, in your studies too, because especially with the teenagers, you know, the kids that are going through puberty and are, they've got the hormone surges and all the other things and the stresses of high school and that stuff. I would think that sleep would have a big impact, you know, and I wonder if there's a way that y'all can make recommendations to tournament directors where, you know, the younger kids start early in the morning, you give the older kids the opportunity to sleep in a bit, and so they're not sleep deprived throughout competition. Is that something y'all are looking at?
Well, I'll address the first part, is that we actually do really believe in the sleep issue and sports performance and injury risk. I'm the first editor on the British Journal of Sports Medicine special issue on the young athlete, and we have commissioned certain articles, and one of them is actually on a systematic review of sleep in the athlete. And so some of our colleagues submitted this started with about 4,000 articles, whittled down to, you know, about 100 that they really closely reviewed. And we do know that there is an injury risk potential, and it probably does impact performance. And it could be the need of getting maybe 8 even to 9 hours of sleep. They've divided up as high as that. So, you know, the night before. And so you all know that that's probably not happening a lot of times. And it's such a simple thing to try to institute, right? But you're also dealing with teenagers and teenage personalities and, you know, college athletes and, you know, folks who are coming from, you know, this is real life too, you know? So mm-hmm. I think the first part of it is, yes, I definitely agree. When we're doing research, you can't have too many hypotheses. So for example, I'll talk a little bit later about our stroke analysis research study, but we certainly believe in it, you know, but the second part of it is actually working with tournament directors to do this. Well, I think that is the biggest challenge, and I can't even for a minute say, hey, look, I have the power, the ability to influence how tournament directors run tournaments, even despite, you know, some data that we have or others have produced on, you know, potential risk and exposure to heat and playing a second match and the rest periods in between and all these types of things. Well, as you know, I mean, there's thousands of tournament directors across the country. So how you reach them and how you implement change really has to come from organizational methods. And that's through USTA itself, which is in of itself a challenge to try to, you know, on the priority list of things, trying to get some of those things modified. There's a lot of things. If you had to write a list of things to do, I think sleep is one of them, but I think there's a lot of things that, and making change, like 51% agree with it and 49% vehemently oppose it. And so, because there's so many stakeholders, as you know. So so I try to stay away from that and just produce the evidence and have the people who are the stakeholders make the decisions about what's the best. We try to deliver the evidence and have the people who make the decisions about how to run things, their academies and the tournaments. I think those they can then apply those decisions.
Right. So I guess, you know, from the parent side and, you know, just wearing my parent hat right this minute, it gives me comfort to know that somebody like you is out there doing the research, A, but B, that you are presenting at these meetings and not just the medical meetings or the science meetings, but you're presenting at the tennis meetings. And so those stakeholders, as you call them, are hearing this data that you're presenting. I mean, they're getting it. And whether or not they choose to act on it, I guess, is outside of your purview. But at least it's in their hands. And, you know, hopefully they will act on it and do what's in the best interest of these young athletes.
So we have had the fun privilege of going out to a number of the academies here in the Atlanta area and doing, you know, testing at a number of the academies and, you know, working with the pros out there and the kids and, you know, obviously the parents get involved. And right now we have about 120 kids enrolled in this, I think it's right around there, in this stroke analysis, like stroke efficiency research study that Mark Kovacs and I are doing. And, you know, it's actually been great. I mean, I really have to say, the pros themselves get it. I think it's just it's a challenge. Like, I mean, they do want the kids to stay healthy, and they want them to be successful. And I think they really, in large part, have the kids in their vested interests. And I think it's sort of like anything in life. Like when it's a small group of people in any system, you know, like there's a small group of people or bad doctors that can make doctors look bad. There's a small group of bad policemen, maybe, that make the whole police force could be perceived as being bad when it's not, you know, and all these types of things. I think, you know, same thing with coaching. I think in large part, you know, like I said, I spoke at the ITA college coaches thing. I think the coaches were phenomenal. They all had the vested interest of their players. And I think I feel that same way about the, you know, junior coaches and the academy coaches. They really do have the best interest in the players. You know, there's maybe, you know, some areas for disagreement on a few things, even between coaches, not just, you know, what kind of data we put out. So it is there. It's just a question of, you know, again, what does it take to develop the best player? And sometimes there's a learning process involved for all of us. So you do one process, you find out, oh, that kid got hurt, because everyone responds differently to it. I have kids who are doing 6 hours a week who've had some serious overuse medical issues. And I kind of scratch my head saying, how did you end up doing this? This is nobody's fault. you end up there. And I've, you know, you have some kids who, you know, who train, you know, exceedingly high and really haven't run into a problem. But so when we give recommendations, what we try to do is give recommendations that apply to the majority of people. And so it doesn't apply to 100%, but the majority of people. You have, and to just be, to have some overall responsibility. And then, and like I said, if it doesn't apply to you, you've been doing okay. We don't want to change a lot, but we had to be cautious. And I think that's what the tours, the WTA and those folks, they're really great at both tours. Actually, we're running our World Congress in Tennis, Medicine, Science in December 2nd through the 4th in Amelia Island. And anyone who's interested, we'd love to have you don't have to be medical to be out there coaching, and any tennis enthusiast. But this is, if you go to www.stmsconference.com, and, you know, we try to present a lot of information. And one thing both tours really are emphasizing, and I'm getting emails from them, both are planning on presenting quite a bit on their screening methods for their players. And they, you know, they want to stay ahead of the game on identifying those that would be at risk and start working on addressing those deficits, you know, where the strength deficits are, those flexibility deficits, where there's pain. And I think there's an opportunity to do that at all levels, actually. And that's where I'm trying. In fact, we're probably going to try to work out something where we have a similar model for the junior players to try to help identify these things and then have them work on it, and then go back to their academies and work on it with the folks at the academy.
That sounds fantastic. I mean, let's face it, the majority of junior players are not going to the pro tour. We hope that a good number are going to wind up playing in college, and we hope that an even greater number are going to wind up playing for life. You know, they're going to stick with the sport in perpetuity of their own life.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, injury prevention is really at the base of any of these things happening. I mean, it's at the base of a kid being able to play on the pro tour. It's at the base of a kid being able to play in college and being able to play throughout life. So it seems to me that it's just such a basic piece of the puzzle that, it's surprising that there's such little data out there, but I'm grateful that you're trying to change that and really trying to educate people. So, why don't you share with us some specifics? I know you said you wanted to talk about how to translate some of this stuff to stroke production and, you know, how that impacts coaching and all of that. So, you know.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you simply why there's so little data. I'm going to take you through what's involved, and we're doing a stroke analysis research study, and I'll tell you what was involved from the beginning of it to where we are now, and then where this would go to at the end of it, okay? And you'll understand pretty quickly why there's not enough research in this area, okay?
Yeah.
So number one, I'll start with, it's un funded in large part. In other words, I don't get paid for doing this, and you know, the folks that I work on, we got a small grant from the foundation that goes to like administrative costs to like run the website a little bit, that does the, you know, surveys and so on and so forth. So essentially it's all volunteer time, right? So this project that we're currently doing now, I would say about 2 years ago when I actually started it, I had, and actually many years ago, but I had been going on court with injured kids when they were struggling with either recurrent or serious overuse injuries. And then instead of just treating the medical side, I would actually take them on court. I taught for many years and look at the things where I felt like I give feedback to the pro that they work with just either once or twice. And we published this on-court stroke modification. We felt like most kids were able to return successfully, like about 90-95%. And some of them were very challenging, had challenging, as they were flying in and coming, you know, from all over just because nobody else was doing, you know, doing this. But to be scientific, I thought, well, why do I have to wait till they get hurt? I wish I could objectively assess them better. So what we did was created what's called a stroke efficiency rating. And this is taking all the evidence that was out there about what certain parts of the stroke would put you at increased risk for injury and which ones would actually improve your efficiency, and taking all the existing data with a little bit of what we call clinical expertise built into that. In other words, you know, just my experiences there, Mark Kovacs, saying, hey, look, you know, you have to have, there isn't data for everything, so you have to fill in the gaps, right? And so we wanted to create a 99 point, like a scoring system, so you could basically say, okay, this kid had, you know, a 77 out of 99 on forehand backhand serve, and, you know, based on basically about 15 areas of the serve and, you know, 10 areas of the forehand and 8 areas of the backhand and so on and so forth, rated between 0 and 3. And to create that, I had actually a tennis medicine internship staff, like from last 2 summers ago, took about, I would say about 9 months just to create, because we know that there are very knowledgeable coaches out there. And if we don't have what we would consider the most evidence-based, the best potential scale that we could have, no one's going to use it, because we're not doing this. Like, both Mark and I do not have the time to go out and actually teach and, you know, and implement this. This is really to produce something for coaches. So then we figured, if you get this scale, a third of them are for, we know, are tied into injury risk, and about 2/3 are for efficiency, but there's a lot of overlap. So, you know, something for injury prevention is actually good to improve your stroke. And so they're not like completely two separate things. So once we create this table, that's all great. That's just the beginning of it. That took 9 months to get to that point. That's just the beginning.
Wow.
So then now what we need to do is get Emory University to approve such an innovative study that they don't do anything on tennis courts. And we're doing minors. We're doing, you know, people under 18. So you have to get approval from the Emory Institutional Review Board, including getting informed consent and approvals for the consent, the study protocol, and that whole package, right? And so that takes quite a lot. It took, you know, several months to just, and we're lucky, I've written a lot of these, so we're lucky we got it in on the first try. Otherwise, it could take 6 months to get approval, right? So then now we're approved to do the study, but then now we've academies to come out to their academies and do research on their players and their parents. And so through, you know, growing connections and, you know, I think a few people through just doing your show and, you know, Mark Kovacs has connections, and we, you know, we have one of our physical therapists from, you know, Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, who's very interested in tennis, Eileen, she would, you know, reach out to folks, and through all this, we're able to get to 10 or 12 or whatever academies. And then in doing that, just getting to the academy, you have to arrange it, get online consent from not only the kid, the parents, and then find a time on their court during their practice. There's a logistic aspect to it, right? So you have to do all this. And then I have a busy clinical practice. I can only go out on Thursday afternoons, for example. And you get out there, you arrange the date, and then some of the kids have their consent sent, some of them don't, some of them aren't interested in it, some of them are. And then you do all that, and then it rains.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Thursday afternoon rains, like it actually happened about a half a dozen times. And so a few of them had indoor backups and other things like that. But, you know, so you have to do that. And this, so in, so now I'm recruiting. We've been recruiting for about four to five months or so solid. And we've accrued about, you know, 125 people, but we still have, they have to complete their consent. They have to complete their player development survey. And then we do a follow-up at 6 months and a year. And you're doing, and then all of this actually, again, remember, you're doing this in addition to your regular life. We find it to be very important. Okay, and there's no salary at the end of it. There's not like a downstream, like, you know, this is going to, you know, like grow a huge portion of my business or something like that, because you're doing this to prevent problems, right? So that's actually bad for my business, right? Because then if people don't get hurt, then they don't have anyone to see, right? But, you know, don't worry, that people will still be getting hurt, unfortunately, through this process. But so then at the end of it, when you collect the data, now we'll have probably, our goal is to get about 200 videos, which is forehand, backhand, surf. So that's 600 videos. Now we have to go analyze them. Again, find a way on your own time and so on and so forth. So then, and then you produce, you know, basically 99-point scales on 600 video, on 200 kids. So it's all 600 videos. You have to analyze it with statistics, which takes, you know, quite a long time to do it properly. Then we present it nationally, and then we try to publish it, which takes probably another year or so to publish it. And then after doing all of that, you might have a coach up there and say, well, that doesn't happen with my kids. So you have to get buy-in, right? You have to, you know, we're not trying to do anything that's in any way threatening. We're not trying to change. We actually said we're not trying to change the style of how people teach or anything like that. What we're trying to do is develop something objective so you can compare and actually encourage people to work with their pro. If you're a 12-year-old kid and you have a score of 31, well, you have a goal then. Maybe when you're 13, you'll have a 40 or something like that, and you'll watch yourself develop and grow, and then you have a more objective measure as you go on. And then hopefully in doing that, you also reduce your injury risk. And, you know, and I think that, and that's the process. The thing I find exciting is that it may help some, but not all, but some coaches change, or, you know, the way they approach giving feedback to their kids. There'll be many coaches who won't use it, don't believe it. And that's fine, because some people have been very, very successful without any of this, but we feel like this can be helpful for some folks who are interested in being, I guess, a little more objective or scientific in their evaluation.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about the process of, you know, getting these studies underway and collecting the data. I mean, holy cow. Thank you. Let me just say that. Thank you for doing it, because I, you know, none of us wants our kid to wind up injured so that they can't do the things they want to do, whether that's play tennis or, you know, just run around with their buddies. I mean, we want our kids healthy, of course. And I think, I mean, it's interesting because I'm a big fitness buff, and I take a lot of classes at a lot of different fitness facilities. And it's amazing to me how many times I walk into a class and the instructor is teaching something that is so dangerous and, you know, just sets everyone up in the class for injury or, you know, extreme muscle soreness or tears or whatever that's going to keep them out of the gym for X number of weeks, and which is the total opposite of what you're trying to accomplish, right? So the same thing on the tennis court. And, you know, I think by studying these various issues, I mean, hopefully, like you said, you know, you're going to have an impact and keep more kids playing and more kids active.
Right. And I don't think there's any coaches who are intentionally trying to figure out a way to get their kids hurt or impact their performance negatively. There isn't anyone who's trying to do that. So, you know, I think everyone's trying to develop their players and get them to be injury free. That's nothing novel. I think everyone's trying to do that. I think the more information you have about how to go about doing that is the better. And that's for coaching. That's for medicine. I mean, it's the same thing. We always had this. We have the saying that in medical school, when you start, about 50% of the things that you learn won't be able to be applied later on in life. They'll probably be wrong. And then because, you know, research and science and over, you know, time, you'll figure out which things are actually correct. The problem is you don't know which 50% is wrong. So you learn everything. And then you go on, you realize, oh my gosh, like, oh, so concussion's a great example. Oh my gosh. I tell parents all the time, like, you know, we see lots of concussions, and, you know, how I managed concussions 15 years ago to 5 years ago to even this, you know, in the last year is actually quite different. And almost opposite in some ways. I mean, it's gone a full, you know, pendulum swing. We used to football games and kid would get a concussion. We'd see him back in 15 minutes. And then if he looked, okay enough. We just do a couple of simple tests and we say, go back in there. And this was a regular standard of care, which is absolutely shocking. Wouldn't even happen in the NFL today. So things go, a lot of different directions. So I think the more information, that's because we've accrued more information and, we feel like we can better educate. Obviously now everyone's aware of concussions and there's a lot of education involved, but, and so the same thing I'd like with tennis, which is just get more awareness of what are the things we can do. But one of the things that we're going to try to do, and maybe we're hoping we can use your platform, is to reach parents and coaches through, kind of medical education, like in performance, series where maybe every couple of months or something like that, we try to reach out to the parents to pick a specific topic and then show them physically how to do their own injury prevention and exercises, and then also talk about any topic from stroke mechanics to nutrition, to female health issues and heat, and using, presenting all the evidence that we know. Basically the same concept we presented our world and tennis medicine congresses that all the tours use and USTA Pro Circuit and everyone, why not give that information? Why hold that information back from our junior players? Like, it's great information. So I think I would like all that same information to go back to our junior players. So hopefully we can, your platform is great because there's so many, such a variety of folks who are on it, again, that are, I think, are key stakeholders too.
So what can we do to help, do a better job with these kids? Because, I know from personal experience what it's like when your kid is injured and can't be on the court, can't be in the gym, and nobody wants to go through that. I mean, the emotional stress of it alone is awful. So talk about the on-court stroke analysis that you do and what you're learning from that.
So basically, I'll go into a few specifics because I think we have a lot of tennis people and coaches and people who understand the game, so they'll understand some of these specifics. But basically, I'll start with one of them, which is the low back, which I always talk about. It was probably the most common reason for me to, at least when, in our publication, the most common reason for me to go on court with a junior tennis player is because of a recurrent low back stress injury, which we can say that probably up to 40 to 50% of young athletes who have low back pain that lasts for at least a couple weeks or more have a chance of a stress fracture in the low back or a stress injury somewhere along that spectrum, which is an incredibly high number. So again, the early recognition, as soon as you have that, that soreness in a high level player, we'd love to take a look at those quickly rather than a late stage lesion. And then when we're done treating, or if we recognize it early and we're able to return them to court earlier, the difference is you get them early, it might take 2 weeks of treatment to get them off, reduce any, injury risk, and then make a stroke modification and send them back versus 3 to 5 months if you get it late. So there's, just to give you an example, the difference of early versus late recognition. And so I had for years, knowing some of the data out there, suggested that, you should not get lumbar extension or low back when you lean back on your serve more than 20 degrees, because we know that in biomechanical studies, that's where it increases your risk of what's called the pars interarticularis, but the back half of the spine gets the most stress, 20 degrees. And so, as you know, many players of all levels do kind of arch their back, particularly on the kick serve. And so the question is, is that really a potential risk or not? So with the kids who have had an injury and had a low back stress injury, it's pretty clear that since the risk of re-injury in the low back is like 5 or 6 times as high, that we have to make that correction. Like, if you already had the problem and if you have a stress fracture, you have to make the correction because it's usually not going to work, especially as an adolescent. So we made those corrections. But the question now is moving forward is when we evaluate these videos is if we see the kids, if you're 12, 13, 14 years old, and you have quite a bit of extension on your serve through either preparation when you're loading or your acceleration phases of your serve, should you make that change before that happens? Because especially if you're doing, like, think of it, you're doing 16 or more hours per week, you're a young growing boy or girl, and you have a lot of low back extension on the serve with high tournament volume. I think if you put it all together, your risk is actually a lot higher. So one of those things has to change. You can reduce your volume, you can reduce your tournaments, you can modify your stroke. And so so you have to look at the whole big picture and say, okay, who's at risk? And that's actually the concept, for example, in the low back. And you ask, like, how can you prevent these things? I think you have to look at all that's in front of you and say, you know, we have something on our website. If you go to like Emory Tennis Medicine, just like kind of go down a list of things and say, look, which of these things does your son or daughter have? Like, how, you know, their tournament volume, their training volume, and all that. And then if they have low back symptoms and they're high risk, they need to be checked out right away. If they're not having pain, but you see this on their stroke, I believe, and we probably will believe if our evidence shows us that those are the kids who have the future risk of having that problem. So I don't think only a few happen by accident. I think most of them are predictable. And since we get more information, they're more predictable. Let's try to get it one step ahead. You won't get all of them, but if you can save a few, you know, then I think, you know, we can, you know, be in better shape. Mark Kovac did a study that, you know, about when should you start the kick serve. And, you know, he published this in our Tennis Medicine Journal, but he had about 100 high level coaches and 100 high level players. And, you know, around the age of just under 13 years old is when they were starting the kick serve, which is probably a little bit later than most people would think. And I think he was looking at shoulder and other areas, but I actually am more concerned about the low back.
And are you saying that just before the 13th birthday, is okay or not okay?
Well, so the thing is, everyone's individual, right? You could have a 13-year-old who's very mature. 13-year-old girl is very mature and skeletally mature and done growing and having, you know, secondary sex characteristics and certainly ready to move on and hit 13-year-old, I mean, hit kick serves, right? You could have a 13-year-old boy who hasn't even hit his pubertal growth phase yet and cannot tolerate that volume at all. And so it is very individual. And that's the problem with trying to make too many blanket recommendations. We have to give a general recommendation, say, look, maybe delay kick serves until at least 13. But I think this doing the stroke evaluation makes it individual a little bit more. So what we're going to do is actually try to collect data on a breadth of ages, and we're using, their height and weight and getting the spectrum of it, and then trying to normalize it for it. So say, look, if you're doing this, you know, how do you compare to other 12 or 13-year-olds that are boys or girls, and really try to put in the context of, a little bit more individual recommendations, because, you know, that would be an easy counterargument as well. You know, I have a 13-year-old girl who's very mature and she's ready for it, and I would agree. So overall, we might say 13 is the number, or we might say, can you hit, it doesn't have to be the biggest kick serve in the world, and I would argue that you can actually get a reasonable kick serve or a topspin second serve in 20 degrees of lumbar extension. And I think you can, and we've seen a good amount. And then you add trunk rotation, and you add what we call sagittal plane motion, and then coronal plane motion, and you can actually make those changes. And I've done that on court a number of times for those kids who've already had the problem. And so, and lower body force generation. So there's a lot of, and, you know, shoulder tilt. And there's really a lot of other ways to accommodate your serve.
One of the takeaway messages I'm thinking about as I'm listening to you talk is the importance of planning in all of this. You know, that you really have got to have a developmental plan for each kid based on their individual weight, height, development, as you know, human development, where they are in the growth process.
Mm-hmm.
And when you wing it is when most of the time you're going to wind up getting into trouble, because all of a sudden you find that your child's overtraining or overplaying in terms of tournaments, and you know, that's when the injuries come. So, I mean, this has been one of those issues that I've talked about a lot over the last few years is, you know, having the parents sit down with the coach and devise a plan. It doesn't have to be a 12-month plan, but it certainly should be at minimum a 3-month plan, preferably a 6-month plan. And, of course, you can reevaluate if things aren't going as you expect, but I mean, if you're just going out there and, kind of flailing in the dark, you're really putting everybody at risk for disappointment and injury.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm actually trying to stay away from just only talking about the injury side because, you know, if you don't get injured, then there's, you know, there's no point in talking about injury. And most kids, you know, aren't thinking about injuries. Most of the thing about performance. So I really, what we call this is, for example, we call this a stroke efficiency rating. What we're trying to do is actually make your stroke as efficient as possible and try to, you know, over many years, you know, there's breakdown and, you know, something happening is, I don't want to say is inevitable, but if you have inefficient mechanics and high volume at some point, you know, the likelihood of breakdown is going to happen. Right. And so the more ways we can figure that out. So like for shoulder, for example, we have about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 solid ways that we avoid hyperangulation where your, you know, where your shoulder, elbow, and, you know, your tossed arm is lined up, a shoulder lag where your arm doesn't get up to 90 degrees of abduction quickly enough. And we call it short arm axis, where when you're making contact with the ball on your serve, that your elbow is straight rather than having even a little bit of bent, you know, parsh into it to reduce the elbow risk. And, you know, we know knee flexion of your rear knee should be more than your front knee. And then Carolyn Martin did a really nice study looking at energy transfer. So basically going from your lower body to your upper body, if it's just like kind of you go down and up real quickly, then you're more likely to have shoulder symptoms and also poor efficiency. And so we like to have people transfer a little more slowly. And so all these things supported by data. And actually, if you watch people who do this very well, you'll see just a really remarkably efficient stroke. And in doing all of that, we believe that you reduce your injury risk because a third of them are related to injury risk, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, I told Mark this, I've done a lot of different research and I've been really fascinated by this particular study just because it, you know, I'm learning so much. It's watching so many different types of strokes and you really critically evaluate so many different parts to a stroke. And I say, it's not, you don't want to just look at the kids that you only work with, but just that like take, you know, you take 10 different academies and you get, you know, 12 or 15 kids from each academy and you kind of pool them all together and you get some data. I think it's really intriguing to see what comes out. And, you know, for my role at the end, like I still go on court when kids get hurt, but now I'm hoping to go on court before they get hurt. I'm hoping actually to make this a thing where we actually, like you said, like parents can meet and I can help work with them potentially. And then, you know, we do an injury prevention screen. We do a stroke evaluation. Then we give them feedback and we communicate with their pro. We're not in any shape, form, or anything like that to run some academy. We want to just give feedback and then have the pro feel confident that, look, hey, here's some stuff that people are trying to do to just help augment what you're doing. And that's really nothing more than that. And I can't stress that enough because I'm kind of new to the area. When I was in Chicago, I think many of the pros knew me for so long. I taught in the area and they knew what I was trying to do. And so I hope, and I feel like, you know, we're getting the same type of positive feedback here where, you know, people know that I'm here, just we and me and the folks that I'm working with on this is, you know, we're just trying to get as much information back to the training academies. Nothing makes me happier than watching a kid that I, you know, got to see and then just go see him at a tournament and have a smile on their face and playing lots of matches and feeling great. So that's really the payment out of it. People, I don't even accept any money for this, which is even the crazier part, right? Parents go, how do you pay you? And I go, I don't know. I go, just send me a picture of your kid at a tournament. That's usually what I say. That's I know awesome. They're doing well. Then, you know, it's so, and it's good. And it's actually, and I tell my, it's not a one-time thing. It's actually, you develop these relationships over years. I have kids who are still coming back who I work with in Chicago. They come back to Atlanta to come, you know, see me and work with me and stuff. And then that's the payment is that they trust and respect you, that you're going to try to, you know, try to give them the best information you can and keep working. It takes a lot of additional communication with the pros and everyone.
So that you're not bombarded yeah. with phone calls and emails after this show.
right.
Is there an age or a stage of development where you would say now is a good time to bring your kid to me and let me take a look? I mean, obviously a kid yeah. just starting out,
Right.
Who's playing, you know, 30 minutes a week or an hour a week. That's, they're not ready to have your intervention at that point.
Right.
Maybe,
right.
Or
right.
maybe they are. I don't know.
No, no, you're absolutely right. One thing I'm really quick to say, the next thing we're going to do is we're going to do this on adults, which is really going to be precarious because we're going to do research on the same thing on all the adult players in the area, and that's our next year. But what we...
Oh, I
want to
be
one of your subjects. Right. I think we're going to get a lot of volunteers. And so I really say, there's no tennis lesson involved. This isn't a tennis lesson. There's no way, there's no capacity for it. You have great people who teach tennis. And so this is... stroke efficiency evaluation and injury screen and those types of things. That's what we're really trying to do. And so, you know, number one is usually want them hitting on the yellow ball at the minimum, and they're not just hitting that. They are really their tournament players. Because if they're still just developing and they're casual player, the interventions we're doing aren't really for kind of the beginner intermediate player, to be honest. And by 90% of them, these are mostly for tournament players. And those are the kids that are really invested, whether you're a part-time or a full-time academy kid. And that would start 10, 11, 12 years old, you know, if you're a tournament player, you know, and occasionally even younger. I've had, you know, very serious 8- and 9-year-olds who we had to evaluate, but are truly, you know, going to be going down that path. I think that's when it matters, because otherwise, if you take a kid who's still kind of deciding tennis is their thing and they're playing, you know, doing a lot of different things, and you know, if it's not that important to them, then they're not committed to some of the work that's involved. So I asked the kids, I said, you know, are you committed towards, how committed are you towards like making tennis, you know, your path? And if they're committed, then I think these things matter to them.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So,
yeah, and I think we're going to work on programmatic stuff for it, but I invite people to contact. I've been trying to, I think I've been able to reach most people who've contacted me. Hopefully, I apologize for those that maybe I didn't get back to them. I'm pretty good about it. We have an Emory Tennis Medicine website, but I can, I don't know how you do communication on it. Or they email you or they, I don't know if I should say my email online or.
Sure. I mean, well, if you want to get the emails, for sure, give it out. If not, if you'd rather them come through me, that's fine too,
okay.
And I'm happy to forward them.
Yeah, sure. And if I just can't accommodate, it's neeru.janethy@emory.edu. So that's neeru.janethy, JAYANTHI @emory.edu. We actually did create an Emory Tennis Medicine page, so people can go to emoryhealthcare@tennismedicine.org. Let me see here. And I think there's a tennis medicine email on there as well too. So that will essentially come to me because I checked that as well too. But again, just, you know, trying to reach the folks that need the help or want the help is probably the best way to, do these things.
Fantastic.
Or you just call my assistant. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, Neeru, thank you so much for coming back on the show and sharing your latest with us. And, you know, we're always here for you when you have something to share. We want to hear about it. So I'm so grateful that you feel comfortable reaching out and saying, hey, I need to come back on. I've got some more stuff to talk about. So that's great. And to my listeners, guys, take advantage. I mean, honestly, he is an incredible guy to work with. Neeru's passion for the game is unmatchable, and it just oozes out of every pore. So I think your kids will enjoy it. He's a fun guy to be around. I think the kids would have a fun time working with him. So I just want to say thank you again. You know, really love
Great.
Having you on
Absolutely.
The show.
Great. And
All right.
We'll have our World Congress in December. Thank you so much. And we'll come
Absolutely.
Back after that.
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Have a good day.
Thanks.
Bye.
You
sure,
too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. To my listeners, hope you all enjoyed today's show. And the podcast will be up in a little bit if you'd like to share it with your friends. Hope you all have a great week. And we'll see you next week on Parenting Aces.